Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at hearstranch.com.
This week on Eat Your Heartland Out, we're exploring the bounty of America's Dairyland. Cheese is the star of this show. We meet an author who gives us a slice of cheese history. And then we also visit Wisconsin, where one expert gives us an inside look at the art of farmstead cheesemaking. Join me, Capri Cafaro, for another episode of Eat Your Heartland Out.
Heather, we're so pleased that you have an opportunity to join the show. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You have such an interesting background. I know we're going to, you know, spend a lot of time talking about one of your books, but before we get into the life of cheese, which is always the life of my party, if I have to be honest, tell us a little bit about, you know, your academic background and how you got into, you know, cultural anthropology and your path.
Yeah, sure. So I studied anthropology in college and went straight to graduate school. My dissertation research I did in Athens, Greece. I studied motherhood and family and wrote a book about that, Making Modern Mothers. And I was living in New York after finishing my degree. And I came into thinking about cheese as a second research project out of curiosity as a consumer. I enjoyed shopping at the little food markets in Manhattan and the Green Market at Union Square and discovered all these artisan cheeses that had been made relatively locally to even New York within a 200-mile radius. Mm-hmm. Cheeses that didn't exist when I was growing up in Southern Illinois. I am a Midwesterner. And I really just became curious about where they came from and who was making them and how they learned how to do that.
So since you mentioned your initial book and some of your initial anthropological research, I do want to just touch upon, you know, the fact that since you talked about mothers and families, mm-hmm. you know, any kind of, you know, we when we talk about food and we talk about cooking and we talk about the kitchen, so much of that is gendered. And, you know, in that particular research, you know, did you find anything specific? Did you look at any of those kind of aspects of, you know, food and gender, and then later on, you know, cheese and gender?
Yeah. So in my dissertation research in Greece, I was really interested in how women talked about the changes in their expectations that were put on them and that they put on themselves for being modern women and good mothers at a time when those were coming into competition with one another. The selflessness of motherhood and the self actualization, right, that is sort of expected mm-hmm. of modern womanhood, they were really struggling with how to reconcile those competing values. And so that is something that's always interested me, is how people in their everyday lives try to live a good life and try to navigate often conflicting expectations and working under non-ideal circumstances, right? Mm-hmm. To realize the promises that maybe they had been raised to imagine for themselves. So when I came to thinking about artisan cheesemaking, one of the basic themes or the central themes of the book is, you know, artisan cheesemaking is obsolete, right? As a mode of food making in an industrial society. It's a lot of work. It is not an obvious thing to do. There are more efficient and cheaper ways of manufacturing food. So what calls people to put in more work than in a sense is necessary to make decent food? And so one of the themes of the book is that in making cheese, people are making lives for themselves, right? Mm. And so what kind of lives those are and what their expectations for a life of making cheese, a life of cheese, is, and how those hopes and dreams are realized or what obstacles they feel are in the way to realizing those has everything to do with gender, right?
Right.
It has to do with, what kind of income, household income they have, what kind of partnership they might have with a spouse or other forms of partnerships, right? There are actually quite a few parent-child cheesemaking teams. So family turned out to be at the heart of a lot of what I studied because these are home businesses, first and foremost.
That makes a lot of sense. And I want to come to a point that you brought up about the fact that this is something that, you know, is obsolete, but people are kind of choosing this life and what they make of it. And I remember when we first spoke, you said that this is something that, you know, you came into around the post 9/11 period. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. It was around 2000. And then I started getting interested. I was living in Manhattan, 99 to 2001. Through 9/11. And so I started being interested in who the people were behind these new foods that were being celebrated, but also regarded with a little bit of suspicion because, of course, they were more costly than the supermarket versions of cheese that we had become accustomed to. So when I started interviewing cheesemakers in earnest, this is around 2006, 2007, 2008, traveling the country and talking to cheesemakers, 9/11 was really this moment when there was this huge surge of interest, not only less maybe in eating the cheese, but in making it. So people really were thinking about what kind of life they were living. And there was a lot of sort of, I won't call it midlife crisis, but existential crisis, right?
Sure.
About work-life balance and so on and so forth. So that was a recurring theme that came up in my interviews with cheesemakers later in that decade, was that 9/11 was this moment of self-reflection and of reckoning with where their lives were heading. And a lot of them were really looking to reinvent themselves, but also trying to think about a project, but also a livelihood that they could share with other members of their family. Mm-hmm.
Sounds very similar to some of the issues, you know, the shifts culturally and economically we're going through right now in this, you know, COVID or post-COVID era, however we want to see it, and the great resignation and how people are trying to ascertain, you know, what's valuable to them, what's valuable to their lives, slowing down their own worth, you know, what's meaningful, all of those things. And it sounds like a lot of that was captured in you know, the interviews that you may had with cheesemakers, you know, over, it sounds like 15 years ago.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's gotten to the point where moving to a farm and becoming a cheesemaker is sort of a meme for a plan B or a New Yorker cartoon, right? For a certain demographic. Right. And I think sometimes I've joked that I wrote this book to sort of dissuade people or rather to give them a more realistic picture of just how challenging this is.
Right.
It is tapping into, I think, a moment, right, where people are wanting to think about their work as more meaningful or meaningful in ways beyond a paycheck.
Right. Sure. So I want to kind of turn to, you know, sort of the core of some of the findings that you had in the life of cheese and I want to return, I think, to some of these concepts around both gender in class as it pertains to cheesemakers and regionally, because obviously this is also a show about the, you know, focusing at least on the Midwest. But I know that, you know, you spoke to cheesemakers, you know, in a variety of different regions of the United States and maybe beyond. But from what I understand, there are some variations geographically between, you know, how cheesemakers approach their trade, so to speak, and whom was engaging in that from a gender as well as class perspective. Can you expound upon that?
Yeah. So, well, one thing, if I can just back up a little bit about the history of artisan cheesemaking.
Absolutely.
In the US. So this is not new, right? cheesemaking and dairy cows were brought to the American colonies by the Puritan settlers. And cheese has been made, you know, in the colonies, in the states, by women largely on farms as part of their farm chores, their household duties, for hundreds of years, from the times of the Puritans up until the mid-1800s, mid-19th century. And at that point, farmers beginning in upstate New York and then quickly spreading into the across the upper Midwest to Wisconsin, dairy farmers started pooling their milk, sort of gathering it together to a centralized location where it could be processed into cheese by a hired tradesman, a professional cheesemaker. In the past, previous to that, it had been made, right, as I mentioned, as a part of the domestic duties of the farm wife. And many women, there's a lot of historical documentation of this, many women really did not like it. It was very hot, working over a steaming kettle of milk. It is very fickle. You know, artisan cheese is not an easy thing to make consistently well. Some women were known to have a knack for it, sort of a feel for the curd and a feel for their cheese, and they were renowned for their good quality cheese. But a lot of women did it only because it was necessary to preserve milk for winter months as a form of food. So cheese is an ancient means of preserving milk, basically. Mm. So in the 19th century, when these artisan factories began, it was really welcomed by a lot of farm women because it was a really onerous chore that was sort of taken off of their plate. And in Wisconsin, a lot of the early cheesemakers who were hired to process, you know, collectively pooled milk of area farmers were recent immigrants from Switzerland and Germany who brought cheesemaking skills with them and developed new varieties of cheeses in the States, in the Midwest, like brick cheese and so forth, that were sort of modified versions of European classics like Limburger that would appeal to a more diverse, heterogeneous immigrant population in the States. So anyway, in the 19th century, cheesemaking was really displaced from the farm across the United States. It really, within a generation, it was cheesemaking was moved off the dairy farm and centralized in these artisan factories. And as part of that shift was also a feminization of cheesemaking. Mm-hmm. So the people employed in the artisan factories were men. They considered themselves trade men. They learned through an apprenticeship program. And it was really just a different, same, very similar kind of cheeses and cheese making techniques and skills often, but scaled up and then masculinized.
Interesting. And so, pasteurization obviously is part of all this too,
so
right?
So this actually predates pasteurization. And then when pasteurization was introduced sort of at the turn of the century between the 18th and 1900s, that was the prelude to increasingly larger quantities of milk being able to be processed at the same time and leading eventually to automation. So that was the case up until around the 1970s. And so it was as an offshoot to the back to the land movement of hippie homesteaders leaving cities and returning to rural areas or moving into rural areas and trying to be self-sufficient for themselves and their friends and living on the land, that goats and goat's milk became part of that hippie ecology, in a sense, food-making ecology. And when Americans just were not very reluctant to drink a lot of goat's milk. Some of these hippie women, and again, this is becoming an offshoot of their cooking duties, right, in the kitchen, right, taught themselves and learned from each other how to make chèvre, how to make simple, fresh goat's milk cheese to make use of that goat's milk. And so that was where these farmstead cheese making was returned to the United States through the farmstead or through the back to the land movement, basically. And a decade or so later in the 80s, like many things that came out of the hippie movement, back to the land movement, they, some of them anyway, started to think entrepreneurially and mm-hmm. got their creameries outfitted for commercial sale, licensed for commercial sale, started selling to restaurants. And that was the beginning of what was referred to as the renaissance of artisan cheesemaking in the United States, where it was really, it started through making cheese on farms, which became a sort of marker of quality, where the cheesemaker was also the person in charge of the health and the well-being and the hygiene of the animals that are providing the milk.
Right.
And so in terms of the gender question, it was, you know, a lot of women at the beginning of that farmstead movement. And then as it became more entrepreneurially, it was really a mix of women and men, sometimes working together, sometimes on their own. But women have really been at the forefront, really been pioneers of this artisan revival of cheesemaking in the United States.
So that's very interesting. And I think about the fact that, you know, now in the 21st century and, you know, even, you know, as you look back at your time in New York, you know, as you're mentioning going to farmers markets, and I have this sort of, you know, vision of, you know, Union Square and that sort of thing in my head of, you know, these artisan cheesemakers and other, you know, produce stands, that sort of thing coming to town and people appreciating and connecting with that quote unquote sort of farm to table concept of, you know, or slow food as well. You have all these like buzzwords of these trends that have kind of unfolded in the last, you know, or become more mainstream. Let's put it that way. Maybe in the last 10 to 15 or maybe even more years where people are looking about where their food is made, who is producing it, how it's being produced, you know, the ecological, you know, and environmental aspects and impact of all of those things. And you know, it seems as if that artisan cheese movement was kind of a little bit ahead of its time in that sense, or maybe was kind of, you know, a pioneer as it was that during that resurgence of, you know, connecting together all of those pieces as that sort of farmstead movement came into that more commercialization phase in the 1980s, where people were then, you know, able to get those sort of things, whether it's at a farmer's market or maybe at a local restaurant. Now, all of a sudden, it is something, as you mentioned, that people are looking towards who are the makers and connecting that to the quality of, you know, the product as well. And I think there's also a, I don't want to, I mean, maybe a moral or value, I guess, a values aspect mm-hmm. to it all too.
Yeah, that's right. It's not only, so cheese might be a value added means of producing milk, processing milk, right? So you're adding the value of the labor of cheese making to milk. So this is actually one of the reasons why farmstead cheese making has expanded beyond sort of these lifestyle people, right? Mm-hmm. Who might have gotten right. going in the 80s. It's really opened up a market and produced a sense of interest in handmade cheese, artisan-made cheese that has become increasingly of interest to some heritage dairy farmers, not only in the Midwest, but also in places like Vermont, where the farms are very small. There's like Wisconsin, there's a long history of dairying in the region. Yeah. It's important to the self-image of both Vermont and Wisconsin as states, but in terms of producing milk, they've been so outcompeted by larger dairy farms in the West that the fluid milk prices, what we pay for milk by the gallon in the supermarket, is really not enough. They get pennies on the pound.
Yeah,
pennies on the gallon. Pound for their milk. Exactly. So, looking for promoting cheese, states are promoting cheese, and farmers are starting to turn to it as a value-added commodity that they can do on their farm that will make enough money that they can hold on to their way of life and their land and their animals and a sense of heritage for many of them. But in addition to the value of their labor, you're absolutely right that what they're adding or deriving both from this work is a whole constellation of moral and social values, mm-hmm. whether that has to do with their commitment to the well-being of the animals that they have, or a love for animals that they have. A lot of the affectionately maybe known as goat cheese ladies. there are women making goat cheese on very small pieces of land with just a few animals and selling to their local farmers markets in virtually every state in this country. Mm-hmm. And most of them get into it because they love the goats. and they are looking for a way to, have what would otherwise be an expensive hobby kind of pay for itself, right? And then some of them really get into the cheese and become really master craftspeople. But it begins with their love for the animals. Other people are really committed to artisan food for the sake of their own health and the health of their community. And others are just really enjoying the creative outlet of the ability to start with really basic ingredients, milk, salt, and some bacteria cultures, and mm-hmm. turn it into an almost infinite variety of really special cheeses. And they love the alchemy of the process of that transformation. So they have a lot of values, personal values, moral values, mm-hmm. social values that are also invested in this work, which is only marginally profitable.
Well, I mean, you can see why, though, because as you just described, the level of complexity, literally and figuratively, as well as the depth, literally and figuratively, of both the process and the meaning behind it is, a good reason, I think, for people to be attracted to it. You mentioned the alchemy of the process, mm-hmm. And the infinite, possibilities. Can you give some examples of, different processes and maybe different cheeses and maybe comparing, you mentioned Wisconsin and Vermont, maybe some similarities and differences between the cheeses produced in both of those places?
Yeah, sure. Well, I would say historically, one of the differences, one of the durable regional differences in cheese making that we have in this country is in cheddar cheese, right? So mm-hmm. cheddar is a ubiquitous and favorite cheese. But if you buy cheese in the East Coast and you buy cheese in the Midwest, it's going to be a different color. So that tradition of the white cheddar in the Northeast and the orange cheddar in the Midwest has a very long history.
And I need to know it. I mean, I need to know why. I mean, I love to know that's, I'm one of those people, and I bet a lot of listeners are as well, of like, why is that? I mean, you got to know exactly. The why. You can't just, consume the mac and cheese that's orange. And I'm sure there's a good reason why powder is orange. That's a whole different conversation, right? we want to know what is that historic difference?
Well, it's really interesting because there's sort of a historical irony. So it does date back to the 19th century, and cheesemakers in the Midwest use the seed of the annatto plant. It's a natural dye. It's a plant-based orange dye, and they started adding it to their curd, to their cheese as they were making it, to produce a uniform color of the cheese throughout the year. So what it was actually doing was covering over the seasonal variation that milk reflects depending on what the animals are eating, whether it's mm-hmm. fresh grass in the summer or hay and grain in the winter. So they were trying to produce uniformity and consistency. Huh. And of course, the historical irony of that is that it is precisely that variability that is today celebrated as an expression of seasonal variation in the land and what they, you know, the fact that the animals are eating different things at different times of the year. And it's that variability that adds to the artisan quality of a cheese, right?
Right. But think about it though, in the back, I mean, and I know you know this because you are, you know, this is your specialty, but, you know, it just comes to mind of, you know, when you think about sort of the industrial food movement and mechanization and all these things, there was this, you know, concept that was valued in regards to uniformity and durability and portability and all of those things.
Absolutely.
And, you know, throughout the early to mid 20th century. So, and as we've been discussing, those kind of concepts have evolved. You know, we obviously still have so much of that in our, you know, culture and our consumerism, but, you know, there was a time in which, you know, variation, I'm sure, was frowned upon. And I think I'm assuming part of that is, you know, due to that industrialization, mechanization, and that assumption that mm-hmm. things needed to have uniformity to have commercial value.
That's right. Well, and uniform value for trade purposes, right? Mm-hmm. So that orders could be put in for a cheese well in advance, and the purchaser could be guaranteed that what they received months down the line would be exactly what they had in mind when they ordered it. Right.
Right.
So it has to do with transportation, bulk ordering, things like this, but also what they were kind of covering over potentially, or one of the values of standardization during early industrialization was also as a guard against what was often adulterated cheese too.
and how is it adulterated?
So there were cases again in the early decades of industrialization of cheesemakers. It was called filling their cheese with lard. They would skim the milk, right, and then make butter or cream make butter from the cream that they skimmed out, and they'd fill that fat back in with lard to make more money off the whole thing.
Right. Sure.
And of course that can cause all sorts of issues. And so, mm-hmm. you know, this is before foods were highly regulated, right?
I was going to say, this is exactly how the FDA like came to be. I mean, I'm now thinking, you know, Upton Sinclair and all of those things and all, you know, labor standards and
Absolutely.
Safety standards and all of those things that, you know, ultimately, you know, came to the fore because of, mm-hmm. you know, questionable practices.
That's exactly right. So some of the markers of standardization actually derive from kind of covering over some of those inconsistencies when today it's the inconsistency that might be upheld as the mark of the true, the realness of the food, right?
Right.
So interesting that historical reversal.
That explains why, you know, Wisconsin cheese may be orange or Midwestern cheddar mm-hmm. might be orange. Why is Vermont cheese white? I mean, I guess obviously the absence of this seed that colored it, but, you know, is there like variations of white because of different, you know, diets throughout the seasons? I mean, is it beige sometimes and more yellow other times, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, what's the deal there?
Yeah, so I think the answer is yes. I think the larger the number of dairy farms that a cooperative would be working with, let's say Cabot Cheese is a cooperative in
right.
Vermont, it pools milk from many dairy farms. The more farms contributing milk, the more consistent the cheese will be ultimately, right? Because it's blended, right?
Mm-hmm.
Variations that would appear are kind of like diluted in the big pool. But if you look at farmstead cheese, like cheese that's made from the milk of a single dairy farm, it will vary. The color will vary slightly. The texture might vary slightly throughout the year. And that is largely a reflection, at least the color is largely a reflection of the fodder that animals are eating at any given time.
Mm-hmm. So interesting. And one thing that I kind of recall you mentioning as well is that, you know, as we're talking about sort of Wisconsin versus Vermont, is kind of New England cheesemakers, maybe artisan cheesemakers, it might be more of a affluent type of activity, whereas, you know, in Wisconsin, more of a trade, you know, something that might not necessarily be an expensive hobby, let's put it that way.
Yeah, there's actually, in both regions, there's actually a parallel history of artisan factory manufacturing that is continued, and then the farmstead cheese, right? The sort of smaller scale and potentially but not necessarily more boutique styles of cheese that are produced to be eaten on their own as part of a cheese board, right? Rather than something to make sandwiches with or put into a casserole. But in both Wisconsin and Vermont and other parts of New England, there are artisan factories that have been in business for 80, 100, even more than 100 years continuously, not to say that they make cheese exactly as they used to, because the safety regulations have changed over time, but the recipes and the fact that they work in open vats and they resisted automation is significant. So, you know, to talk about an artisan factory does not have to be an oxymoron. That early period of the factory production, it was artisan methods, right? Meaning the cheesemaker was very knowledgeable of the curd and how it behaved. The vat was open to sensory and not like, it was open, right? It wasn't closed and fully automated. This is pre-automation. So the cheesemaker would have to get their hand into the curd and squeeze it and feel whether it was, you know, ready to move on to the next stage of the production process. Really embodied skill is necessary. And that style of cheesemaking has continued in some artisan factories both in the Midwest and on the East Coast. Just a handful. But what they've been able to do in the last, say, 15, 20 years is kind of piggyback on the farmstead revival and not change the way that they've been making cheese, but change the way they've been packaging and marketing their cheese. So what had been just sort of old-fashioned cheese is now today artisanal.
Right.
And so there's one example of this from Wisconsin is Widmer. Cheese. They are in Teresa, Wisconsin. Joe Widmer is the current owner, operator, and master cheesemaker there. He is the third generation cheesemaker at Widmer's. His grandfather his grandfather was a immigrant from Switzerland in 1905, and as a condition of his entry into this country, apprenticed with a Swiss-owned cheese factory in Wisconsin, and eventually bought his own factory, which now his grandson, Joe, is the operator of. And what Joe has done is not so much change the recipe. They still make brick cheese the way his uncles and grandfather did. They use masonry bricks to weigh the individual cheeses to press the whey out of the curd. And it's very old school in the manufacturing. But what the current owner has done is, instead of just selling the cheese to local delis to be sliced for deli sandwiches, they're packaged in small wedges and sold at the Whole Foods Market alongside the artisan cheeses. And so it's, calling attention to the real artisan skill that's behind making it, and then sort of, putting that brick cheese alongside some less familiar style of cheese.
Sure. As we start to wrap up our conversation, I wanted to ask if there's anything else in, you know, your studies or in your travels about, you know, Midwestern cheese production that you felt our listeners need to know as far as, you know, the uniqueness or anything specific, or maybe even a story just like the one that you shared that might stand out that shows kind of the complexity and the role that cheese and cheese making plays in, you know, Midwestern culinary landscape.
Yeah, I would first call attention to the Greene County Historical Cheese Society Cheese Museum. I think it's in Monroe. It's been a while since I've been there. But there's a really excellent cheese museum devoted to telling the history of the rise of the factory system. And it's really interesting museum. But I guess the story I would tell is I would suggest that one of the best things that has happened to Wisconsin cheesemaking in, you know, in the contemporary era, let's say, was the California Milk Marketing Board in 2005 put out a big TV ad during the Super Bowl. And you might remember this. This is 2005. Mm-hmm. It was the great cheese comes from happy cows and happy cows come from California.
Yes.
And that it was a Super Bowl ad and then got a lot of airtime, of course. And that ad from California, it transformed Wisconsin cheesemaking. Or what it did was it got the Wisconsin state government to invest in not the quantity of Wisconsin cheese, but in its quality. Mm-hmm. So they started investing in consulting and supporting the smaller upcoming artisan factories and artisan farmstead operations and marketing for quality. And that included things like reminding people about the historical significance of cheesemaking, its place in Wisconsin, the fact that there were these artisan factories that had been in continuous production for three generations, making really beautiful cheeses. They also talked about the unique qualities of the pastures of the Driftless region in southern Wisconsin, where the latest glacial period, the glaciers didn't cover where they sort of stopped. And mm-hmm. so lands, pastures that were unique for that reason. Anyway, just really calling attention to the different quality characteristics of Wisconsin cheeses. And but it just really goes back to that great cheeses come from happy cows and happy cows come from California rivalry.
Nothing like a good rivalry to get the Midwest going.
Rivalry. Yep.
That is interesting. And now I'm never going to think about the happy cows thing the same. I totally forgot. I remember it now that you say it, but I totally forgot about it until you mentioned it just now. Because sometimes I actually talk about when I'm abroad, I've talked about how it's happy cows. There's such a different, you know, dairy that you get, you know, even in Canada for that matter, because of regulations and whatnot. And I'm like, it's the happy cows. And now I realize it's internalized mm-hmm. and it really is a Super Bowl ad. So thank you.
And not only that, but it was California where, you know, the dairy farms are really big. And so it maybe not such a happy place, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely. Well, you know, here at Eat Your Heartland Out, we're all about the underdog, or I guess in this case, the under cow. And we celebrate this craftsmanship that we have, you know, in the Midwest with these incredible cheesemakers. And Heather, I want to thank you for sharing your expertise and so much, you know, interesting history and insight on the art of cheesemaking. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Stick around for more cheese talk on Eat Your Heartland Out after these messages.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Welcome back to Eat Your Heartland Out. I'm your host, Capri Cafaro, and we have been talking about all things cheese this hour on the show. Previously, I was speaking with anthropologist and author Heather Paxson, who is the author of The Life of Cheese. And now I'd like to welcome our next guest, Andy Hatch, proprietor and master cheesemaker at Uplands Cheese in Wisconsin.
Andy, welcome to the show. We're happy to have you.
Thanks, Capri. Happy to be here. Thanks for asking.
Well, I've visited Uplands Cheese in Wisconsin, but for those folks who are not familiar, didn't have the wonderful opportunity I did to come to your manufacturing facility and your dairy farm, Paint us a picture. What is it like there at Eplin's Cheese?
Well, today, looking out the window of the farmhouse here, it's sunny and white and very quiet. So we are a 500-acre dairy farm with 200 cows, and that makes us about average in our part of the state. We're in the southwestern corner of Wisconsin, so very hilly. It's a beautiful landscape, what they call the driftless part of the state. We don't milk our cows in the winter. We're a seasonal dairy farm, so there is kind of a blanket of silence that falls on our farm this time of year, and it's really peaceful and quiet. So the cows, I can see them in the distance out in the field eating hay, and you know, they are content and pregnant, and I'm warm in a sweater inside talking to you. It's a nice peaceful day.
That definitely is, I think, what they would call pastoral, right? What yes. you just painted for us. Earlier in the episode, I had a conversation with an author all about artisan cheese and Midwestern cheese and kind of what makes it special. What brought you into, you know, what attracted you into cheese making? Would you consider your method, quote, artisan, which I know is sometimes slapped on a lot of things these days?
Yes, that term gets a lot of lip service, and but in our case, we're a little bit unusual in the context of Wisconsin cheesemaking, in that we only make cheese out of our own cows. So that would make us a farmstead cheese operation. Most of the cheesemakers in Wisconsin buy milk from multiple different farms, make multiple different styles of cheese, and that's kind of been the approach here since, well, you know, the 1860s. So not to say we're any better or worse, but our approach is to use only our own milk and only make two different cheeses, and each cheese in its own season. And so in doing that, what we're really trying to do is kind of distill the flavors of our particular farm and herd of cows and make something original and unique as opposed to, say, making cheddar or Colby or Swiss and trying to make a lot of it, put it out into the market. It's, you know, I think it's a really compelling way to make cheese, to look at it like that. And then as a business strategy, it's recognizing that we're never going to compete on, you know, low cost of production or big marketing budgets. So rather than make something that somebody else makes and compete on those terms, we try to do something unique. And, you know, a farm like ours, an unusual herd of cows like ours, we think we have something special to share.
Well, I can definitely vouch for that, having been out there. But, you know, you just mentioned that you have two different types of cheeses that are seasonal. What's the difference and what makes them different?
Yes. We make a hard cheese, an aged cheese called Pleasant Ridge Reserve. And we make it in the spring, summer, fall when our cows are grazing on fresh pasture. So like I said, I can see them out on the hilltop now in the field, and they're going to stay out in the field for the next few months, but they'll start to drop their calves in another couple of weeks here. And through April, as they start calving and the pasture starts growing, they'll gradually eat less of the hay we put out for them and more pasture, less hay, more pasture. And at the point when they will ignore the hay altogether and change to an all pasture diet, that is when we start making this cheese, Pleasant Ridge Reserve. And we'll make it 7 days a week nonstop until the pasture runs out. It's essentially one big harvest of that grass-fed milk. And the cheese is made and tucked away into the ripening rooms on our farm, where it'll age for about a year. And so really what we're trying to do with this cheese is sort of capture the character of that grass-fed milk, which takes months of aging to kind of reveal itself, not unlike, you know, a Bordeaux or a Burgundy or red wine, and then release it the next year. It's sort of bottling sunshine, I guess.
I love that.
Coming into the fall, grass, you know, the pasture stops growing and we have to start supplementing with hay again. The milk changes quite a bit. It loses some of that kind of flavor complexity that comes off of grass-fed milk, but it gains a lot of weight or texture, gets richer. Fat content goes way up. So less ideal for an aged cheese, but perfect for a soft cheese where you want that texture and weight in the milk. So then we start making a cheese called Rush Creek Reserve, which is sort of the other side of the coin for our farm. It's the opposite approach. It's openly ripened for 2 months. It's meant to be eaten over the holidays. So we make it in the fall, sell it all in November and December. It's a very luscious, like custardy texture. And
would you say it's more like a brie, for example?
Yeah, the texture is similar to a brie. It's wrapped in a strip of spruce bark, which lends it kind of a smoky, woodsy flavor. So it's much more savory than brie. We think of it almost like a savory custard. It gets kind of ham or bacony type flavors.
Well, I'm sure that, you know, everybody is, their mouths are watering now. Our audience is excited. And you do have such a unique approach to cheese making. And your story is interesting as well. And Wisconsin is kind of unique because it's my understanding that it's the only state in the country that I think requires a cheese making license and some very specific training. I know you went through a lot of that. Walk us through what you had to do to become the cheesemaker you are today.
Yes. Well, the cheese industry here in Wisconsin was built by, you know, largely German and Swiss immigrants. And they, you know, brought with them in the 19th century, I think, you know, kind of that classic Middle European approach to, you know, apprenticeship and then a journeyman and eventually a master. And so we've still held on to that here. To become a cheesemaker in Wisconsin, you need a license. It's the only state that requires that. And so you have to serve usually several years as an apprentice, take classes at the university, pass a written test to become a cheesemaker. And then a decade or more later, you're allowed to start the process to become a master cheesemaker, which in itself takes many more years. It's
you
formalized.
Have to like pass the cheese bar. It's like the bar for cheese.
And
becoming a lawyer or a doctor, it sounds like.
Yes. And, you know, one way to look at it is that it's a hurdle for entry. And maybe that's true. You know, I think the idea is it is a hurdle for entry in an effort to protect quality and reputation. But at the same time, it is a very collaborative place to make cheese. Most of the businesses here are old family businesses, but I wasn't born into one. My parents didn't milk cows or make cheese, and it is still a place where it's possible to break into, you know, a very traditional industry and have people that will support you and help lift you up. So I started here on this farm as the hired cheesemaker. It was actually the last apprenticeship I served, and I just never left and ended up buying the farm about 10 years ago.
And you have a partner who is, you know, kind of deals on the farm side. You're on the cheese side, and then there's the cow side, right?
Yes. Yeah. So two families, all of us are about 40 years old. We've got young kids. And at the same time that I was the hired cheesemaker, he was the hired herdsman on the cow side. And so he and I bought the farm together, our two families, and everything is right down the middle, 50-50. But Scott and Liana Marika handle the cows, and Caitlin and I run the cheese side. Not a conventional approach, you know, to cheese making, but, you know, we use unpasteurized milk from a single herd of cows. Milk quality is everything. And so I was really attracted to the idea of a partnership with somebody who's, you know, milking the cows, somebody whose livelihood depended on the cheese. And it works for us. We're really lucky to have each other. It'd be too much for one, I think, family to handle.
And your wife does some of the artwork, right? For the cheese. I remember walking away with a beautiful like poster that was illustrated that, you know, came out, I think, for each year that you do the cheese, right?
Yes. Yeah. I'm actually recording this now in her studio in our house, surrounded by a mess of paints. And it's the quietest room in the house. So, she paints watercolors mostly, Caitlin, my wife. And every year when we release Rush Creek, the soft seasonal cheese, it's become kind of a cult classic type cheese. You know, the people who wait for it all year, and it comes out and it's, you know, Thanksgiving time. It's like, you know, buying a special bottle of champagne that one time a year. So people wait for it and it's an event. And so she paints a poster every year to kind of commemorate the season. And you can, you know, buy them on our website, or you find them hanging all over the country in cheese shops.
How cool. How cool. And, you know, I know that, you know, you brought, you said this was the last apprenticeship that you had, but you also went abroad, right, to learn from cheesemakers in Europe too.
I did. Yes. I spent a couple of years working as an apprentice around, you know, Western and Northern Europe, Norway, Ireland, Italy, France, Austria. And it was in my young 20s. And I mean, it was as much about wanderlust as about, you know, refining my craft. But it did give me a glance at a lot of different types of operation. And it solidified in me the idea that when I came home, I wanted to own cows and make cheese. Like I said, it's not the common setup here, but you know, what I saw in Europe was, you know, the potential of a cheese when you're able to control everything from the breeding of the animals to the feeding to how they're handled in the barn. And that's really what was attractive to me about this place.
Right. Well, you know, it's not always about what is, you know, obvious or commercial, but, you know, Uplands Cheese is very unique, and what you've described is really incredible as far as, you know, your commitment to that, you know, integration of, you know, the cows and how the cows and the seasons ultimately create these cheeses that only come out, you know, twice a year. Do you have any future plans? What do you think is on the horizon for Uplands?
Well, we grow at a pretty slow, steady pace, but it's been steady. You know, for us to make more cheese, we need to, you know, raise more calves, and they don't have their first calf until they're 2 years old. And then you make a little more milk, and then you make some cheese and you age it for a year. So we take things pretty slowly, but we're at the point now where we need to expand our cheesemaking facility. It's a small building. It sits right next to the barn. As you remember, the milk just comes underground. Yeah. And the obvious move is to, you know, add on to that building. But what's actually going through our heads right now is putting up a new building down on the road. We're on a country highway, you know, two lanes, 55 miles an hour, but it's, you know, stoplights. But It's going through farm country, but there are quite a few people that drive by, and we're getting interested in doing something more public facing, you know, a retail shop and a chance to do a little bit of education. I worry more and more the last few years how animal agriculture has been vilified in the press, you know, oftentimes with just sloppy, untrue statistics, or, you know, painting a picture of all farming systems as the same and inherently evil. And, you know, as less people in our country farm, I think less kids are getting close to cows and cheese. You know, grandpa doesn't farm anymore. The uncles don't farm. So we're thinking about, you know, trying to do something that's good for our business to sell cheese directly to people and give them a chance to connect more with what we do, but also bigger picture, I think our industry needs to be more proactive in showing people that there are responsible ways to manage land and animals. And so that's kind of what's on the dashboard here. It's something that won't happen in the next few months, but probably in the next 2 years.
Well, I mean, you certainly have that commitment. And I think that, you know, consumers really can benefit from that education. Understanding where their food comes from is critically important as people get further and further away from the farm, you know. And so people, as you just mentioned, also recognize that, you know, rightfully so, people, you know, want to make sure, you know, many consumers want to know that, you know, their food is ethically sourced, and you're doing just that. And it's, I think, a great idea to be a little bit more public facing on some of those things and share your knowledge with the public. This is exciting, Andy. I can't wait to come back and visit again. Thanks again for joining us on Eat Your Heartland Out.
Of course. Always happy to chat, Capri. And we love the work you guys are doing with the show. I'm happy to be involved.
You've been listening to Eat Your Heartland Out. This episode was produced by me, Capri Cafaro. Our audio engineers are Liam Warner and Armin Spengen. Theme music by Jason Shaw. You can learn more about the show by visiting heritageradionetwork.org/Eat Your Heartland Out.
Eat Your Heartland Out is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.